Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. Okay, we are in paper 58, section 6, which is old single column, page 669. All right, so we, they gave us just their brief little comments with some big asides, but their brief little comments stepping us through pre-animal life. You know, the implantation of those of the original single-celled plants, single-celled eukaryotic life. So we've got the actual evolutionary life up and running. As they stepped us through, we have 100 million years under our belt, right? Of the plant life really getting established and beginning to evolve, and now we're ready for the first single-celled animals to appear. So that's the big transition, as you see by the title of section 6. However, as I've been stressing, you know, we stressed even before we had any life at all, and we were just way back, we were just getting the solar system formed and everything. You know, the only reason that the universe exists is to be inhabited. You know, all evolution has one sole purpose. Doesn't matter what, if it's ultimatonic evolution, you know, into collections of 100 ultimatons, the evolution of collections of atoms and molecules as a gas into a large, you know, gaseous cloud that, you know, becomes a spiral nebula and all, you know, a spiral galaxy. I mean, it doesn't matter what evolution you're talking about. So definitely, you know, even these 100 million years, right? What humans looked like 550 million years ago was a single-celled plant. Right? I mean, everything is the evolution of humans. That's the only reason those single-celled plants are there, because eventually they lead to the first two true humans. Yes, it is the case that all of the bridges aren't burnt as it moves forward. Right? There, you know, you don't end up with nothing but humans. All of that plant and animal life that doesn't, you know, fade away because it was just scaffolding is ongoing because it's part of allowing humans to be ongoing. It's not just temporary scaffolding, it's long-term scaffolding. The adjutant mind spirits that we're about to have in play when we have the first animals have their foundational ongoing seats, you know, their foundation, their footing on those ongoing orders of animals that, you know, as we get into this, you know, we'll see that often there are certain species that come into existence and then they stay constant, for hundreds of millions of years going forward. Why, you know, and you go, well, why don't they continue to evolve? There was all this rapid evolution, and up to them, why did they stop? Because that's their point, is an ongoing platform for the humans above. The second adjutant, you know, perhaps has its ongoing seat on those certain animals. And so, you know, but lots and lots, you know, a lot more animals that are alive, you know, have gone extinct because, especially on this decimal world, this experimental world, an awful lot of life is just dead end stuff. Yeah, it's very much either a rapid means to a greater end, or it's just in order to get to the ends that they want, you can't help but having a few little tangential dead end things that happen too.
Sounds familiar.
Right? So there's, but just to appreciate, to think about the evolution of life in that definitive way, that we're about to see humans make the step from plant to rudimentary animal. And all of that, you know, just, you know, to stress that this is the evolution of us, all of that is still in us, right? You still have a plant foundation. Yeah, you don't have chloroplasts that are, you know, with chlorophyll, you know, that are converting sunlight and energy. No, not literally like that. But when you're attacked by malignant bacteria, say, they're attacking you on your plant level. If you didn't have a plant level, you wouldn't have that problem of being susceptible to being engaged down there at the plant level. You know, that's the whole point of the biologic uplift, if we'd gotten it fully, is to really definitively lift us enough above that plant level that it's not an issue, you know, if there's bacteria that are harmful. But we didn't get that uplift. So, you know, in a critical way, we're still down there at eye level with a plant attack, a vegetable attack, right? All right, so it's, you know, that fundamental mindedness of a plant is mechanical mind. You know, the whole foundation of your organism is regulated by that mechanical mind. If you didn't have that plant-like mind, that foundational mind, you wouldn't, you know, there would be no regulation of your body. And, you know, like I was saying, it just needs a more aggressive over-control, right? Yeah, it's not as over-controlled as it's supposed to be, so it's susceptible.
All the way back to the saline part.
Yeah, right. Right, and yeah, so they're going to stress that again, you know, that we've got evolving saltwater oceans is part of the evolution of humans. You know, take a look at, you know, if you're in the hospital, you know, what kind of a fluid they're putting in your veins, right? All right, so yeah, just I'm stressing that up front because we are, you know, getting really close now to kind of launching into a lot of factual details. And it might seem tedious if you don't keep in mind the truth of what you're reading. It's the point is not immediately the facts. Yeah, there's lots of facts that, you know, are there for helping making the science of geology all the more true a science, yes. But, you know, if your immediate goal is not to be, you know, a PhD level scientist, you know, why would you want to be studying these papers? You know, and it's because you're trying to understand what you are, right? If you want to really understand your life, there's three parts to that understanding: origin, history, and destiny. And if you don't have all three, you don't have any true understanding of your nature. Right? And this is part of your origin and history that's embodied within you. Okay, so let's see what they give us here.
Chris?
Oh, you had something?
A really brief question.
Yep.
So Dennis Brody's asking, do you think that if scientists and doctors knew more about this plant basis, would they be able to handle our diseases?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the main things. I mean, in all sciences, the more of a philosophic whole that you think about the issues of the parts within, the more likely it is that you will get that insight that you need, right? I mean, if you definitively think about it, it's like, okay, this is not just parts of a human. This is the plant aspect. And if that was really fundamental in your mind, I mean, I certainly can't give you a specific, but that would undoubtedly awaken a potential insight. Right? To have that framework, that context, just in the back of your mind, as you're down there in the details as a scientist and studying, and you go, oh, wait a minute, that reminds me of, right? You'd get an insight. You know, the more you know about the truth of what you're studying, the better you can work with the specifics of the facts, right? More efficiently, the more effectively you can work with the facts. Yeah, especially when you really would like to take the facts, advance the facts forward to something, say, that could never be subject to cancer again, say. Right? You got to understand what you're moving forward, the truth of what you're moving forward. All right? So to get that insight, because it's not going to come from just studying the information. You've got to, the breakthroughs come from insight and that philosophic wholeness of recognition that you have relative to the specifics. Okay, let's get into it here.
Section 6, the transition period. 450 million years ago, the transition from vegetable to animal life occurred. This metamorphosis took place in the shallow waters of the sheltered tropic bays and lagoons of the extensive shorelines of the separating continents. In this development, all of which was inherent in the original life patterns, came about gradually. There were many transitional stages between the early primitive vegetable forms of life and the later well-defined animal organisms. Even today, the transition slime molds persist, and they can hardly be classified either as plants or as animals.
Yeah, just that last little comment about slime molds. You know, you can look at them, and, if you study them, not just any given part of their whole life cycle, but their entire, life cycle, it's like, well, when I look at them, in this mode, that's pretty plant-like. But when you look at it in this mode, it's like, well, that's an awful lot like a protozoan, an animal. Right, that's what they're getting at. I was just mentioning, remember you've got, all you have is mechanical mind engaging all this vegetable life. And you can see they're pointing out that mechanical mind has a very extensive, continuous hierarchy. Right? Mechanical mind doesn't just function on a very precise low level. And it functions from that low level all the way up to, its highest levels, like in a material son and daughter, and mechanical mind is engaging them and forming their foundation. And it's just very, it's a continuous spectrum. It's not, a discrete set of levels. And so you get this phenomenon. As there's evolution, it can be just very, very, very gradually filling out all the possibilities in that smooth continuum of minded potential. And again, let's stress it right up front here. Why do the material structures evolve? Is it because material structures are magical and they just do that? And then there's this other stuff called mind that the Urantia book throws in and it just, engages whatever the heck is magically there. No, the evolution is coming from the top down. There's an influence imposed upon the material system from the top down, down through mind to the matter. Right? That evolutionary process is coming down through the mind into the matter, and moving the form of matter forward in an evolutionary way. And so you've got, because it's coming down through mind, and this mechanical mind doesn't have any sort of gaps in it where, it needs to bring the matter up across a real big divide in that mind energy system. It's, it can do a totally smooth, gradually, to higher and higher forms relative to smoothly higher and higher mind, right? That is, that matter is coming into sync with. Yeah.
So you have mind as a actative thing coming down, but the potentials, don't the potentials have to be there from the get-go, though, designed in the matter?
Right, so the matter, remember, I set aside a couple little issues there. Number one, the material system was designed, and so there's variability, that potential, designed into the literal material structure that the life carrier, they literally built those first eukaryotic cells, right? And they build it with variability built in. And then the other little thing, remember that through the life carriers, you had life animation engaged to that properly designed matter. And the life animation is what's really animating that variability potential, right? I mean, obviously, if it wasn't animate, it couldn't vary. You know, you can imagine rearranging the molecules of a, you know, a chunk of granite, right? But it's not animate, right? So how could that variation come about, right? So you sort of loosen the constraints on that variability potential by adding that life animation. And then, you know, we'll get to it a little bit, but as long as you brought this up, there's another potential, again, remember, that's coming in because of mind energy, adaptability. Right? And so that potential of adaptability that's in mind can actualize in living matter below as adapting life.
Well, there is a new potential with the
right.
mind.
Right. You don't, you know, you need more than just variability. You need adaptability. You need to get this, you need to vary it in just such a way that it's adapted to the environment or other organisms.
Isn't that another quote? The purpose of life is
adaptability. Yeah, right. Now, the meaning of life is its adaptability. The value of life is its progressibility. I see. You know, meaning, that's mind. I see that potential of adaptability is in mind. Progressibility, that's in spirit energy. And you're going, well, I mean, okay, as long as we're off on this tangent, I mean, not only, you know, is this coming down through mind, even though there isn't spirit directly tied to any of these organisms we're talking about here, plant or animal, the mind energy system that's engaging them has spirit energy above it within, you know, in the creative mother spirit. You know, it's her mind that's engaging here, right? So, you know, you have progressibility being actualized down in it too. It is it just isn't individuated like it is with a human, you know, that progressibility potential. You know, so yes, this life isn't just evolving horizontally. It's not just adapting. It's evolving vertically. It's progressing. And we just got it to, you know, a key vertical threshold. It's vertically going to go from plant to animal, right? An awful lot of what we, you know, what the evolution before that, it's a little bit vertical, but an awful lot horizontal, right? And there continues to be horizontal, but you're going to start to bring in these very definitive upward steps now, where that progressibility gets actualized in a very profound, stepwise fashion, which is about what they're going to tell us about. But okay, but to continue with this first paragraph, just to think about everything there. The other little thing we want to keep in mind: remember how, as we were going from 550 million years ago to 500 million years ago, I pointed out that if you match up the dates, the actual dates they're giving you in the Revelation for certain events, and you compare that to how we radiometrically date those same events, you can look at this date ratio. You know, and it started with a factor of 4 at 550 million years. Just 50 million years later, at 500 million years ago, it was down to a factor of 2. And now, yet another 50 million years later, at 450 million years ago, it's down to basically the level it's going to be at going forward until very recent times, geologically recent times. It's the ratio now is about 1.4, okay, instead of 4. You know, so the radiometric date for, you know, the corresponding to what's an actual date of 450 million years ago is about 650 million years ago. Okay. So, you know, we're a lot closer, right, in ratio, but it's still, radioactivity is still at a higher level back then than now. But we see, you know, in this, from the time that you had the first eukaryotic plants to now the first eukaryotic animals, eukaryotic animals, period, right, basically, the master physical controllers have taken definitive control of this environment and gotten it quite clamped down. Again, we don't understand all the reasons why, but it certainly seems reasonable that as we're going to more sophisticated systems, you know, moving ever closer to humans, or maybe moving ever closer to mammals, maybe think about it just that way, they're obviously having to clamp things down. It can't be as robust a background environment. That sub-electronic environment can't be as robust for whatever reasons that we don't understand. But it's obvious from looking at this side effect, you know, of how it's affecting the radioactivity, that has gotten definitively modified now, much closer to what it is now. And so that must be, you know, under the life carrier's orders, those master physical controllers are keeping things conformal to what the life needs to stay viable, you know, and also to not only viable, you know, but also to be properly stimulated in ways we don't, you know, completely understand. The life carriers are very much guiding life forward in a very hands-on way until you get the first two will creatures, right? So, you know, they're, yes, it is evolving, but, you know, they're not in there literally, you know, rearranging, you know, molecules in chromosomes, you know, but they are very actively involved in controlling it indirectly via the environment. You know, including, you know, when things start to, when you have land animals and things start to migrate about, you know, they start to, let's make it so they, you know, coincidentally go this direction instead of that direction, because that will be better for the future. And so they're very hands-on, the life carriers, in these early stages, guiding it.
Invisible walls.
Yeah, yep. All right, so... Okay, so you've got that big issue that as we get to the, you know, these first single-celled animals, you know, remember protozoan, you know, literally means first animal, right, etymologically. You know, so we have the first animal, a protozoan. Yeah, so we can have all these different protozoa. Single-celled animals, and we'll go forward from there. Okay, so anything else that I didn't get in there? Again, it's all dependent upon the continents having split, like, you know, we talked about, and getting these, as they say, sheltered tropic bays and lagoons. Yeah, and, you know, when you see that sheltered bays, right, you should be immediately thinking, ah, yeah, that's right. And we stayed effectively in those sheltered bays until just... You know, as they were giving us the fifth epical revelation, basically, and saying to us that the Supreme has now pushed you out of the sheltered bays. All right? You are now on the high seas. And you need to be able to sail yourself. All right? If you don't have your chart and compass, civilization will collapse. All right? So you need more than science and religion. You need philosophy now. You need that big picture context. You can't be all burrowed down in the scientific or religious details, you know, on the poop deck of your ship out there in the high seas. You've got to have a big picture. Is there a hurricane coming? You know, what's going on the high seas here, right? Yeah.
I wonder if my dinghy's really going
to
make this work.
Okay. Yeah, so that's why the fifth epical revelation is here. You know, so see, just notice you know, that. I mean, they're purposely saying it that way, right, to get you to appreciate that, you know, just what a big transition is in play right now with civilization. The sheltered bays that have been there, you know, since 550 million years ago, in effect, even if they aren't literally, right, sheltered bays. Okay.
Yep. Although the evolution of vegetable life can be traced into animal life, and though there have been found graduated series of plants and animals which progressively lead up from the most simple to the most complex and advanced organisms, you will not be able to find such connecting links between the great divisions of the animal kingdom, nor between the highest of the pre-human animal types and the dawn men of the human races. These so-called missing links will forever remain missing for the simple reason that they never existed.
And I'll have you read the next two paragraphs first before we really flesh that out. But just notice in the earlier part of that paragraph when they said, you know, this graduated series of plants and animals which progressively led up, right? What was I just saying? That progressibility, right, that's in spirit energy, that potential, it's in spirit energy and gets actualized down into mind energy as progressing mind, right? That's the fundamental reason why there's vertical evolution, why there's anagenesis, why things go up, right? And not just horizontal evolution, you know, where they adapt into different niches, you know, horizontally and interact, you know, one organism with another and whatnot, right? But why do things go up like this? Why is there something that's going, you know, that's being led up, like they're saying there, see? Spirit is leading the mind up, and the mind is bringing the matter up with it. So these organisms are going up. And as they're pointing out, you start to get you get these breaks. What was all, you know, purely gradually now has gaps. Where, you know, like they're saying, either between the big divisions where you can see very definitive gaps, like, you know, and you can imagine, well, like one of the reasons you might have a big gap in sort of different divisions of life is this lesser life only has, say, the first two adjutants. But this greater life has three adjutants now, right? And that, you know, there's no adjutant 2.1, 2.2, 2.3. No, it goes from 2 to 3, one step, right? So there's this big gap. There are no creatures in between those that are the lowest with 3 and those are the highest with 2. Right, so there's this big gap that will remain forever missing, as they're saying, because it never existed. And with one jump, you had a creature that has had just the two adjutants, and they produced an offspring that had 3 and wasn't their species anymore. Right? You know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Right, the egg. You know, it's just that one day a chicken came out of that egg, but a chicken didn't lay that egg. Yeah. Suddenly, there was chickens. Right? And that's what we're about to read. And we want to think about why that is. Why do we go from gradually to sometimes suddenly? You got something? Okay. All right, so let's see, anything else here? Oh yeah, you know, I didn't totally stress from that first paragraph. But notice, you know, that they, you know, you don't have, even though it is the case that you suddenly had the first true animal, right? So there's a distinct gap. There is a whole borderland phenomenon, okay, you know, that is still confusing to this day about, You know, you started out, recognize there was plants and animals, and you want to try to put everything, first to put everything, you know, in either the plant bin or the animal bin, right? And, you know, and as you're going through all the things, well, okay, giraffes go in that bin, you know, magnolias go in that bin, right? It's like, well, which bin does this thing go into? You know, which bin does the sponge go into? Right? And, you know, it started to get a little confusing with, you know, some of these things. And that's funny because down there, there's near that border between true plant and true animal, there's this whole fuzzy area because of that intense gradually of mechanical mind. It will forever be, you know, an asterisk, right, to simplistically classify certain creatures, whether or not they're quote-unquote plant or animal. But see, the whole point is really kind of just put that whole preliminary phenomenon in the rearview mirror. What we're really interested in, you know, is getting this suddenly phenomenon going. And we have the first suddenly, the very first one, suddenly there's an animal, a true animal, right? The first true protozoan.
So in order to understand this scientifically, you almost have to believe it spiritually. Or
We're going to get to that. You don't have to believe it spiritually.
You know what I mean? You can't believe that there's a suddenly being designed.
No,
there's
nobody
to design it.
No, you can. That's what we're about to explain.
Oh, you think?
Yeah, because they're going to tell you that we have to explain it that way in one of the sentences we're about to read. Okay, so let's read those next two little paragraphs and talk about this. We need to understand the suddenlies.
From era to era, radically new species of animal life arise. They do not evolve as the result of the gradual accumulation of small variations. They appear as full-fledged and new orders of life, and they appear suddenly. The sudden appearance of new species and diversified orders of living organisms is wholly biologic, strictly natural. There is nothing supernatural connected with these genetic mutations.
Right. Okay. So, you know, people like Darwin, right? Yeah, back in the 19th century, we're starting to study, and they're going, wait a minute, I see all kinds of adaptation. Right? He was noticing all of the precise details of horizontal evolution, the gradually of horizontal evolution. And everything he was recognizing there is completely valid. You have this you have a gradual accumulation of small variations. That's all completely valid for horizontal evolution, but not for vertical evolution, you know, once you get past the, you know, initial confusing stuff, right? It isn't pure gradually, there's suddenlies, okay? Now, species don't come into existence as Darwin falsely extrapolated, right, in his, that seminal text, right? He put the word species in the title, right, because he was taking it a step too far. You don't go vertically merely by a gradual accumulation of small variations. Okay. And you're going, oh, so it must be some sort of intervention by spiritual beings or spiritual forces or whatnot. No, it's not. Right? Way back when, you know, they called these suddenlies saltations, jumps. Vertical jumps. Okay? And, we've kind of convinced ourselves there aren't saltations, even though initially it looked like the fossil record was certainly saying there were saltations. And we've closed one eye and squinted with the other, and, you know, we've convinced ourselves that there aren't saltations in the paleontological record. But there are. There are genuine suddenlies. And this should not be difficult for any physicist to understand. Every physical system works this way. It's nothing supernatural. There's nothing really that deeply mysterious about it at all. Right? If you take a physical system and you put it under a constant external influence, that system, you know, begins to change gradually until suddenly there's a phase change, right? Simple example is, you know, that everyone can understand, get a pot of water, put it on the stove, pot of cold water, put it on the stove. And you can stick a thermometer in if you want to really be scientific about it and collect some data, right? Yeah, you turn the burner on. It doesn't have to be on very high. And you don't touch it. You leave it on. So you have a constant external influence imposed upon that system, that water, that physical system, that water in that kettle, right? And you watch it. And the water temperature...
It boils when you watch.
We'll set aside the old wives' tale about a watch pot never boils. Right? I mean, you just watch it. And what do you see that temperature doing? It goes up gradually, right? It never jumps. It's a perfectly smooth gradually. And then suddenly the water boils, right? With no change in temperature, right? And there's a boiling point. Right? Now, did the temperature gradually go up because you were slowly nudging the knob up on the stove? No. Did it boil because you grabbed the knob and gave it a good twist? No. Right? Was it a father-like intervention that made that water boil? No. No. That's just the way physical systems work.
There's something else that happened. The temperature quit going up.
Right? And it does a phase change, and then if you have of course if you have the water vapor contained, you can continue to drive the temperature of the water vapor up, but the whole phenomenon switches gears and goes into a different mode, where instead of what's the influence going into just making the temperature goes up, it goes into this very definitive rearrangement of the system. A phase change.
What you just said a minute ago about going from, two adjuvants to three adjuvants, and in terms of that's really what the step is when you evolve animal and plant life, so to speak.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, if the adjuvants are involved, let's say, then doesn't that mean, for people that really, other than observing that it happens, to explain that it happens in a, how should we say it, in more of a way that we learn through revelation than we actually understand?
Okay, all right, so, yes, I think I do. So, I was just going to get to that. So, now, in this initial step of going, we've got plants, and then suddenly there's an animal, okay? And coincidentally, okay, the system takes this sudden jump up to a new state, and coincidentally... the first adjutant can now engage it, and that matches up perfectly with where it is. Right? So, the mechanical mind is the means for the influence to be imposed upon the physical system. And there's this suddenly, and quote-unquote coincidentally, it goes up a notch where that's exactly where and how the first adjutant reaches down and engages. So you're thinking, so is that all it is? It's like kind of what you're saying. Is every notch up just like, okay, then there's going to be all gradualities, and then suddenly you're going to have the second adjutant? No. Without a new adjutant, you can have just the first adjutant, and this external influence continues to be imposed in a constant fashion, and suddenly you've got a different animal, a fancier animal. It still only needs the first adjutant. I mean, all insects just use the first adjutant. Insects are a lot different than a protozoa. A protozoam, right? Different than protozoa.
Is that then a horizontal?
No.
Okay.
No, it's verticals, right? So,
it's not involving an adjutant.
It's not involved, it isn't such a vertical that you have to bring into a new adjutant and engage it, but you've engaged a higher functioning of that adjutant. See, so coincidentally, within that adjutant, it can engage it in a higher way. Okay. Okay, up to a point, right? And then you're going to have to bring in another adjutant. But if you, but when you bring in another adjutant, that allows that lower adjutant to function in even higher modes than it could, you know, on its own. Okay, and we won't get to it here. You know, they really bring it out way back up when we get to paper 65, and they're talking about this mindal over control of evolution. But one of the big things, big differentials in how the adjutants engage life is there's two basic modes. The adjutants can engage, and this is how they start, by engaging each individual organism as an individual organism. There's an individual mode of each adjutant. But eventually, the individuals evolve to the point where they can function as a collective. And there's, coincidentally, see again, quote unquote, right? There's a higher mode where the adjutant now can engage it in a collective mode. Okay, rather than just, you know, the part-wise mode. So you can have a colony of cells. For instance, you know, just starting with the first adjutant. You know, each cell, you can take it out of the colony and it'll still function as an individual. Right? You know, so you know the first adjutant is still engaging it in that individual mode, but you know the first adjutant is also engaging the collection of cells in a collective mode. Yeah, which means in the collective, that individual cell does things that it can't do on its own. There's a super additive consequence, right? A super summative, right, consequence in that, you know, more than two collective mode like that. Okay, so you have all of this complexity in the adjutants that can conform to these suddenlies, but just appreciate, you know, the inherent in a physical system, a purely physical system, and you don't even have to have an animated physical system. Just a, you know, the, you know, pot of water, that water's not animate, right? It's just H2O molecules, right? Any physical system can go through phase changes. See, so the origin of species come about by a phase change in the system, just like water boiling, right? Or another simple analogy I always use is, you know, take a plastic ruler, you know, and put it between your two, you know, flat palms, you know, horizontally, and just, you know, very slowly and gradually move your palms together, you know, and watch that plastic ruler flex gradually, right? And it'll do that. It'll evolve, right, quote unquote, to different states gradually, gradually, gradually. But suddenly, it snaps, goes through a phase change. Right? Every physical system functions like that. That's what the that's what the suddenlies are, right? Yeah, and in the case, you know, when things snap, you know, you know, it doesn't necessarily go up. It might go down, right? Okay, see, that's what they're stressing, right? You know, why did they, you know, why didn't they put those two paragraphs together in one paragraph?
Why didn't they?
Why did they make two separate paragraphs? And see, there's the first basic fact about suddenly, not gradually. Okay, so that's one point. And then there's the additional point that they know every, you know, the people that are initially reading this book are not geologists. Right, they're religionists, right? And their first thought is, "Oh, the father just poked his finger in and intervened because that's the only way I've been trained to think about everything." No, the gradually and the suddenlies are all in the mother. Father has nothing to do with it. Right? It's not divine intervention of, you know, father injecting into the system. Right, you didn't reach in and grab the knob on the stove and give it a crank. You didn't do a father-like intervention into that. It's all inherent in the over-control of the mother with that system. You know, and you know, because it's all there. I mean, who coincidentally has that mind that is ready to meet up with that suddenly uplifted physical system? She does. Right, she's the wholeness in which all this is happening. Right, there's no surprises. Right, there's no coincidences. You know, in supremacy, at the biggest scale, right? It's all inherent in the system. That the suddenlies that her influence produce, she's there to meet them perfectly when they happen. So that whole bit of that produces species and diversified orders of living organisms is wholly biologic. Oh, it does say wholly. Notice that? It didn't say totally, didn't say entirely. It said wholly. Right? The whole and the individuality of the whole. Right? It's a mother phenomenon. Right? You can't understand evolution with just God the Father. I mean, if you try to do it with just God the Father, it'll be a magical story. It'll be no better than the magic matter story you got right now with scientists. You know, you'll just turn the magic matter story into a magic man story. And that's not an improvement. Right? it's a slight improvement that, you know, the magic man you think of, you know, being kind of quasi-causal. At least he, you know, goes abracadabra and, you know, moves his magic wand, right, and causes something to happen, right? But see, it's strictly natural, strictly. Right? It's all inherent in the system. There's nothing magical or mystical or, in, you know, God the Father interventionary about water boiling. That's inherent in the system, and, you know, and in the wholeness in which of the mother, in which all the physical system, all the mind systems, all the spirit systems exist. The triune energy system is in her wholeness, and coincidentally, it all works together. Right? Mind can engage matter coincidentally, quote unquote. Spirit can engage mind coincidentally, quote unquote. Right? You know, why? Right? Okay, so that's a big thing, see? And at the time that this book was being written, you still had an awful lot of those from the 19th century that were struggling with this whole bit of, okay, how do you bring God and evolution together? There was a lot of champing at the bit, right? And there's no way to resolve that. I'm trying to just stress that. The tension was appropriate. You needed to be saying, you know, from your religious upbringing, okay, I can't have proved that there is no God. But it also doesn't appear that, that quote-unquote God the Father, the magic man, is behind this. It seems natural. Well, how do I resolve this issue? You need the other parent, right? The way of evolution, you know, is the answer to these questions. It's not the will, right? The will of evolution is clear back at the beginning, before anything started, right? He's not the way, she's the way. So everything that happens, the immediate answers to the mysteries is not him, it's her, right? She's the reason such and so happens such and such way, right? So to really transform and bring that that true philosophic perspective into biologic evolution, right? I mean, there was a truth to what you said up front, right? You need more than matter. You do need spirit, and you need mind. You need all three, and you need something that encompasses all three of those. Yeah, and that's not the Father, right? The Father delegated engaging matter to the Isle of Paradise. He delegated engaging mind to the third person. He delegated engaging spirit to the second person. So he's not going to be, he can't do this. Right?
So the appropriate answer to the postulate, hey, God does everything. Appropriate answer is no way.
Yeah. No way. No, comma. Way. Not will. Right. Okay. So suddenly there are phase changes. I mean, you know, a scientist, you know, should his delight should just go off in his mind. It's like, oh, to think about the saltations as phase changes in the system. Oh, I mean, they would be off to the races if they could allow themselves to to have this richer perspective. I mean, the things that you could then explore, it's like, whoa, phase changes. We need to figure out exactly what's the physics of all this, you know? You try to start to sort all that out. It's like huge vistas just open up of scientific exploration and potential discovery, right? And that's how scientific discoveries happen, when there's a philosophic context in which that exists. How can you have a vista if everything is an island universe, right? I mean, that's why everything has gone dead in science, right? There's no way to have a vista that it can open up anymore because there is no context in which a part exists, right? It stays forever locked, right, in its little pool of ignorance. Yeah, so. Is there a question somewhere? Yeah, John.
Yeah, well, but back to the whole, you know, the concept of the mother,
yeah,
as or the mother God or whatever, mother in that context,
yeah,
is, I hadn't heard about it before the Urantia book much. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's pretty new,
yeah,
as far as the revelation is concerned when you put that together. So it seems to me that it's going to take some, whether it's religious, spiritual, or whatever it is, understanding or belief that, you know, there are things behind these things happening.
That are of
something that other than what we normally consider just material or natural, so to speak.
Yeah.
In depth.
Right. And the answer comes in paper 101.
Oh yes.
Okay. Where, you know, they explain how can you go beyond so God the Father or the Universal Father, you might say, you know, for a key nucleus of a religion on one side, and a first cause, or an absolute, for science on the other side. What do you need to do to bring those two together? And they italicize that the answer is not God, or an absolute. It's deity. Right? God is a religious word. Right. Absolute is a scientific word. Deity is a philosophic word. You have to go up. Right? See, again, why is the first section in the foreword not about God? Why is the second section about God? Why is the first section about deity? Because you have to transcend God. You have to go what's above God. I mean, I was fudging a little bit. I mean, technically, you don't need God the mother. You just need the mother. You need that deity, right? You don't need a person acting. You just need that kind of deity functioning, right? You aren't just replacing, you know, a magic man by a magic woman. That's not what we're doing here, right? We're really recognizing that this is not the domain of a person. Like a personalized deity, like God acting at all. This is fundamentally deity functioning, right? God the Mother does this not because she acts, but because she's made out of the deity that just functions this way. She doesn't have to choose this. She is this.
So it's who she is.
It's who she is.
Does she love?
Is the deity, yes, she does. As a person, she loves, of course. But see, we're setting that aside. See, we're just, what she is as deity is a type of deity that coordinates all of these parts into a system. Right? Mm-hmm. She's what's between that which is visible and pokeable. And right, that, you know, there isn't a vacuum between the things. And it's filled ubiquitously with mother deity. Right? There is no relationship between mind and spirit without mother deity. There is no relationship between matter and mind energy without mother deity. There's no bringing it to coordinating it into a whole without mother deity. It's what allows it to not be magical. Right? It's what makes it a logical, literal fact. Right? Things aren't magically coordinated. They are logically coordinated by a literal fact, mother deity, bridging the differential.
Does that the truth behind the facts?
That's the truth behind all the facts, right? You know, and if we could see all three kinds of facts, you know, matter's facts, spirit facts, and matter facts, mind facts, and spirit facts, you know, if you could poke all three, you know, with your finger, right, you would recognize that no matter how much you studied just the facts, you know, and how much knowledge you had of those three facts, you're missing something big. You're missing the big picture, the whole, the context. You're missing the truth of the situation, right? The truth is in that wholeness. It's not in any of the three parts. You can't find truth in spirit substance anywhere. You can find it in material substance or merely in mind energy. And it's in the triunity of their wholeness, right? And they're coordinated together. Therein is the truth. And so, you know, this, it doesn't matter if you're trying to get true religion or true science. You can't get true religion without philosophy. You can't get true science without philosophy, right? You have to go up to the whole and then approach the part, be it a spirit part or a material part, anew from the top down. You got to put the spirit parts in a whole, or you'll never have any true relationship to the spirit parts.
Yep. I just finished reading a really interesting book called The Swerve. And have you read it?
Yes.
Fascinating in this context to think about what the rediscovery of Lucretius and On the Nature of Things did to the Catholic Church in the 16th century,
mm-hmm.
and how they felt it was an either-or thing. And it just, you know, it threw everybody for a loop. But this mm-hmm. What you're talking about bridges it. It comes, brings it together.
Right, right. See, it's, you know, the deeper you get into the philosophic reflection of things, the more inescapably you recognize that there's fundamentally a part that's always been missing in the picture, right? You know, the more you reflect on the Universal Father, the more it becomes absolutely clear to you that that's God as transcendence, not God as immanence. And it's like, well, if I'm not orphaned by that recognition, well, where's the God that remains within? Where's the God that's immanent? Where's God as immanence? You know, what is ubiquitous all around, you know, through me and between us? What coordinates it together into a whole? If I recognize that, you know, that God the Father is on the outside, and he's the injection to what's inside, right? It's just there waiting to be logically recognized. Right? You have another parent. You have a spiritual father, but you have a cosmic mother. Right? You don't have a cosmic father, and you don't have a, you know, just merely a spiritual mother. You have a cosmic mother, right? And there's, you know, individuality, associativity, and unity, and a triunity in that cosmic mother. You know, and the father is just an injection of spirit influence into the system, right? He initiates you spiritually, right? Gives you a personality so that you can grab a hold of spirit with that spirit pattern, right? He initiates you spiritually. But then what? Okay, now that I can grab it, what do I do with it? Right? You need to consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. You need to take the matter that you can't help but be connected to and the mind that you're right in the midst of with your thoughts, and you need to bring those three together into a harmony.
Then he gives you the thought of us to help you do that.
And then he subsequently, you know, he'll give you a nugget of harmony, right? As an internal reference point, you know, what does harmony look like? And that's where you need to really kind of fundamentally recognize that it's not so much a spirit fragment as is a deity fragment, right? That thought adjuster, right? it isn't just an initiating fact. You know, I mean, you know, it's an on, it's part of you in an ongoing way. I mean, eventually, it's, you know, it's sort of, you know, the core of your being, right? Yeah, so it's, you know, all of this, you see, has sweeping consequences, but it's just to, you know, it starts with some simple recognitions like this, that the most basic aspects of studying biologic evolution is a study in the existence of your other parent and her influence on the system. Things don't evolve because the father pokes them from outside. He doesn't stick his finger in and poke them. It's like, go forward, you know, and he just keeps poking them. He doesn't micromanage things by poking them forward, right? And he doesn't need to do that because he delegated the whole thing so that it naturally happens within. He doesn't have to poke his finger in, right?
So then the supreme being, then, that comes out of the end of that, how does that...
Okay, that,
so that's another discussion.
That is another discussion. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry,
that gets a little bit more complicated to go from God the Mother to God the Supreme. But okay, but anyway, right here, we're just trying to recognize that, you know, this distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, we're studying a cosmic system. The individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. Right, the mother deity is the individuality of the whole. Right? It's through mother deity that all things are connected together and hence coordinated into a system. The aside is the fundamental fact that she's the individuation of, you know, if she's the individuality of the whole, what's the whole? You know, that's the Paradise Trinity. Again, that's not the first person, that's not the second person, that's not the third person, that's that fourth fact. Right? You know, really, if you go beyond just that immediate question of, am I saved? All your remaining questions, the answer is not God the Father. If they're deep questions, the answer to the question is God the Mother and the Paradise Trinity, right, that the Mother deity stems from. I mean... And we've been trying to answer all of these other questions with Father. You know, and these early biologists and geologists and stuff, you know, as they were trying to think about what they were discovering, they were struggling with this. They were trying to somehow shoehorn, you know, the universal Father, you know, into what they were discovering and get him to be the answer to the mysteries, you know. And the more they tried, the more those that, you know, weren't inclined to try to shoehorn God into the picture. You know, we're looking at what they were doing and saying, you know, you guys are just like whacked. Okay? I mean, that is like just so arbitrary, off on a tangent. I mean, that doesn't give me any reality response, right? You know, and the more people tried to shoehorn God the Father in to make God the Father illogically both God as transcendence and God as immanence, the more they tried to do that, the more those that weren't initially inclined to believe in God were driven away from God. Because they're driven away from magic. I mean, as a scientist, you know, you're fundamentally driven by that insight of your first cosmic intuition, your logical acumen. And you just have a gut-level rejection of magic creeping in. Now, it's sad to record that scientists are no longer scientists, you know, and they allow magic in because they aren't fundamentally driven by the first cosmic intuition anymore. You know, they're just driven by the second adjutant and rationalizing things. Okay? So they've let magic back in. But initially, right, that's what caused this great schism. You know, it was people trying to make the Father do the things that obviously logically the Father couldn't do if he's got his transcendence. It's just a simple recognition. It's like, well, I have two biologic parents. You suppose I have two heavenly parents? Yeah, you suppose? I mean, how could you possibly have two biologic parents if you didn't have two heavenly parents? That would be illogical, right?
Yep. Jones needs a reminder of the definition of philosophy. He says, philosophy has been quite a part of Christian growth and development, but often expressed theologically. Why does theology fall short of philosophy?
Okay, well, I mean, I don't get too technical here, but I mean, you know, theology, is the logic of God. Logic is about philosophy. I mean, you know, why do we call it geology? Why do these ends, these words end in L-O-G-Y in logic? Because, I mean, we used to recognize that fundamentally it's the wholeness of logic, the philosophic context, and then within that you're trying to think about the parts, like the part issue of your individual relationship with God the Father, right? You were attempting true religion, to understand the immediacy of the personal spiritual experience in the context of a logical whole, and develop a theology of your experience. But the problem is, when I'm saying philosophy, again, you can't look up what the word philosophy means in the dictionary. You can't go to any philosopher that's lived for the last 2,600 years and have him tell you what the word means. Humans have been trying to figure out what that word means for 2,600 years. And only with the fifth epical revelation can you finally recognize, oh, that's what that word is referring to. And no wonder we couldn't quite get it, because we didn't fundamentally recognize the physics of it. On one side, you have science, and on the other side, you have religion. And they come together, and you go up as a super additive consequence. We've been searching for philosophy down in the plane with science and religion and haven't been able to find it. Duh, because it's not in the plane. It's above. No wonder you couldn't find it. Right? You have to go up. And to fundamentally recognize that you can't have any genuineness to a philosophic picture if you don't have, basically equal measures of, relatively genuine science and genuine religion that you're putting together to get a super additive consequence. If they're radically out of proportion, or, if one is basically almost totally false, I mean, you're not going to get any sort of a genuine super additive consequence. That's what we're talking about. That's why I keep stressing, don't think so much philosophy and all of the baggage, human baggage of that word. Think whole, not part. Science is about material parts. Religion is about spirit parts. This thing I'm calling philosophy is about the whole in which those two parts exist. And if nothing in the dictionary or in history sounds like that, then you don't start there in seeking what I'm talking about, right? The dictionary still says quid est veritas under that other word that's related to the whole, truth, right? Humans have never been able to figure out the whole thing. Truth, meaning, a philosophy. I mean, why do we still try to figure out, what's the meaning of life? I mean, right, there is no meaning in a part. Right? This is fundamentally where we're at. Okay, if we've boiled down, so we have this, there's a system, right? It's not just a bunch of parts. There's a system. And a physical system, even that's more complicated system if we have both material and mind energy. But that whole system, right, is going through a phase change. Right, it's a phase change in the system. Suddenly, eventually we'll have suddenly there's fishes. Right, it's not because mom and dad were fish. No, mom and dad weren't a fish. The baby was a fish. Okay.
And suddenly there was lots of
mom and dad weren't true humans, but Anna and Infanta were. Mom and dad were animals. Kids were humans. Right? Suddenly there were humans. Okay. And that's all inherent in the system. Okay.
At the proper degree of saltiness in the oceans, animal life evolved. And it was comparatively simple to allow the briny waters to circulate through the animal bodies of marine life. But when the oceans were contracted and the percentage of salt was greatly increased, these same animals evolved the ability to reduce the saltiness of their body fluids, just as those organisms which learned to live in fresh water acquired the ability to maintain the proper degree of sodium chloride in their body fluids by ingenious techniques of salt conservation.
Okay, so what kind of a potential are they most immediately talking about there being actualized?
Humans.
Adaptability. See? Right? Talking about that basic horizontal phenomenon of adaptation. Right? Actualizing that potential in mind energy, adaptability, you know, as adapting life. You know, down to adapting life. Right? So, and just giving you that simple example. So you could say, there's a million examples of adaptation they could have pointed out. Did they mention this? You know, why did they mention this one? Well, because, you know, they already mentioned that before, so it's a simple one to just take one notch forward and say, remember that saltiness we talked about? It had to evolve just merely as a physical system to a certain stage before we could implant the first single-celled plants. They got it just the right saltiness that single-celled plants needed, so they didn't have to adapt to it. They could just be immersed in it, and it was just right, right? Not too big, it's a Goldilocks salinity, right? Okay. But then they're pointing out, it's not like the magic man takes a hold of the system and holds it in the magic, Goldilocks state, right? And things are going to evolve, and the life has to adapt to that, right? Again, I don't want to start a big aside, but this should immediately remind you of something. You, living on this planet, think about how humans are tending to think right now. That everything is in this magical, divine Goldilocks state right now. Right? And, it is raw evil if there's any change in the physical system that we might have to adapt to.
Right. Oh, no, I got to move out of my place in Florida.
We're desperately white knuckle trying to, it's like, no, we're not sovereigns of the external world any more than these poor old animals were sovereigns of the external world. If the solidity changes, you got to adapt, bud. We're not sovereigns of the outer life. The only place humans have sovereignty is in your inner life, as an individual. Right?
Even in light and life, don't we get more sovereign over?
No, we're still not all. We put ourselves in cooperative subordination to the sovereign and be the hands of the sovereign, but we still recognize we're not sovereign. God the Supreme is sovereign of the finite domain. Remember what do the life carriers get to be sovereign? No, they do a decimal world. Because the sovereign is changing. And every 10 worlds, roughly, they've got to do a test to figure out where the sovereign wants the external world to be. And they put themselves in cooperative subordination to the sovereign. Right? And again, they're not sovereign over the external world anymore. They're a lot beyond humans and light and life, right? Goodness, these are the life carriers. They're designing the life and stuff, okay? They humbly know they're not sovereigns either. Michael knows he's not. He's sovereign of his local universe, but that's in the context of the grand universe, and he's not sovereign in the grand universe. He has to, that was the whole point of his seven, bestowals, to put himself in cooperative subordination to the whole, right? He's not boss. He humbly bows before the sovereign, of the bigger picture. All of this is, we're slipping into this self-righteous mode, and projecting it outward, so that we think we're sovereigns of this, we're trying to lock it into some existential, eternal state. We can't allow any changes. It's like, no. things are going to change for lots of different reasons. And it gets more and more difficult as you go forward, because the more you go forward, once you sail out of the sheltered base, humans are supposed to be have greater and greater impact on the system. Okay? You know, so, you know, again, you know, it's not bad if we have a profound impact on the system. You know, we're moving towards light and life, where things and beings are together in a totally coordinated system, like in the on the Havona world. So you've got this very difficult thing of figuring out, you know, where the line is between where you're supposed to be doing something or not doing something, you know, and, you know, when it's, you know, in the hands of the sovereigns. You know, like politically, the Most High is ruling the kingdoms of men. They're sovereign out there. Not, we're, none of us have political sovereignty, ultimately. But that doesn't, right. Can you think, that's what I'm trying to get. Do you immediately think, oh, dichotomy? Yeah. No. No, there are no dichotomies. That's your first challenge, is to try to think of anything outside of a dichotomy. Humans are not trained to do that. Everything you've been, since the moment you were born, you were trained to think of everything in a dichotomy, black and white. You know, you watched movies and there were black hats and white hats, exactly. Right? I mean, you've been trained from the time you were born to think of everything in a dichotomy. You know, and nothing is a dichotomy.
The Most High, Most High concerns cooperative subordination to the.
To greater picture too, to the supreme, you know, as well, right? But you know, they're the immediate sovereign hands of the supreme, you know. So you've got, you know, you have all these. Nothing is simple. Dichotomies are for simple minds. That's why everyone on the planet thinks in dichotomies, because everyone are simple minded. You know, and so everything is black and white. Nothing's black and white. It's all very complex, and the only way you can sort it out is having a whole. You know, you can't just treat it down on the plane. These are good parts on this side of the line, and these are bad parts, and it's all very simple. There is no such thing. And all right, so again, just adapt. God gave you a mind to adapt. The planet is going to radically change over the centuries and millennia in the future. There's going to be radical changes in this planet for all kinds of different reasons. And that's why we have a mind, to adapt. You know, and one of the easiest ways to adapt is to have the wisdom, insight, and foresight to not do something now as if now was eternity, thinking that things are not going to change, that building on a sandbar is like building on the Isle of Paradise. For instance, okay, sandbars are sandbars, okay, right? People in Florida, you know, have to worry about how vigorous kids in the swimming pool are. You know, they might slosh the whole state away. Right? It's barely above sea level, for Pete's sake. It's a sandbar. You know, I mean, right? That is not a very long term wise thing. To build eternal estates on a sandbar, yeah, et cetera. Okay, you get my point. I mean, that's what we need to get some wisdom in here again. All right, let's keep going forward.
Study of the rock-embraced fossils of marine life reveals the early adjustment struggles of these primitive organisms. Plants and animals never cease to make these adjustment experiments. Ever the environment is changing, and always are living organisms striving to accommodate themselves to these never-ending fluctuations.
See, didn't they just stress for you there? Right, was it all past tense? No, what does it say? They never cease to the never-ending fluctuations. Right. We're trying to be the collection of molecules that our false science has told us we are, right? The materialism, the philosophic materialism, right? Hence, you know, we want the world to be an estate that requires no mind, because we're told we don't have a mind, so we don't have adaptability. So if we don't, you know, zealously try to keep all the molecules from moving, you know, we're screwed. Right? Because we're just collections of molecules. It's like, no, you have a mind. And the only reason you have a mind is to adapt. So guess what? The powers that be throw changes at you. so that you have, you know, there's some reason for it to have a mind.
Right? I just realized I'm carrying baggage about my preconception of what it's like in enlightened life. Oh, that'll be when we have everything locked down. No. It's just the opposite.
Right.
It's when,
again, what do they tell you again in the religion papers? You know, when they bring up this subject, they say, and remember, even an eternal universe changes. Right? The beings in the central universe have to have minds. They have to adapt. Right? Before there was the super universe level, before there was the finite, right? They had everything all locked down as all neat and tidy. And then the powers that be changed everything in the central universe. And they had to start totally from scratch and readapt to everything. Everything in the central universe changed when they made the super universe level.
It's kind of the beauty of it, though.
Right, that's the whole point. The whole point is to adapt to change. See, think about it, just how false we're getting. You know, we're schizophrenic about it. You know, on the one hand, we'll say, you know, what do we want? Change. When do we want it now? You know, and then in the next breath, say, don't change anything. You know, you're evil if you change anything. It's like, well, I mean, we're just completely schizophrenic about this. The more that we try to lock things down and not let it change, the more the powers that be are going to push it, right? The speed bump builders. So you don't want things to change, huh? Okay. Try to hold on to the molecules when we do this to them. Right? It's a very immature, worldview that we've adopted here. You got to adapt. Things are going to change. Never-ending fluctuations. Seventh stage of light and life. There's never-ending fluctuations. Right? And those won't be easy fluctuations. Those will be really complicated fluctuations that only super advanced seventh stage light and life minds even have the ability to adapt to. Right? The challenges get greater as you go forward, not less. You're not heading towards the drop of water in the ocean bliss thing. Right, you're heading towards the absolute. The challenges get greater and greater and greater. Right, you face all the challenges of circuits 7 through 3 in Havona, and you think, okay, I have just climbed. There is no higher peak. I've reached the apex of challenge. And they say, no, you're going to go to the second circuit now. You haven't even been challenged yet. Wait till you see the challenges that await you on the second circuit. Wait till it isn't, you think you've been going up a hill, but relatively you've been on a plane. When you see how steep it is on the second circuit, now you'll see what a climb looks like, right?
This was an entire deity or the other class. What is it that you said about motion? Because it was something about motion equates to, was it energy is motion or...
Energy is motion, yeah. I mean, and just that recognition that you got matter, mind, and spirit, they're all three energies, and energy is motion, so all three are motions. I mean, again, it just reminds you, how are you ever going to escape change when it's a universe of motion?
Yeah, the hallmark of nothingness is no motion.
Yeah, and the only thing that's changeless is the Isle of Paradise, but, you know, I mean, that's the inner part that no one can touch, right? It's internally changeless, right? But there's all kinds of change on the surface, right? I mean, there is no place you can go, you know, that's that absolute sheltered bay of changelessness where you can just lay back and bliss out, you know, on a pool of constancy. There is no such place, right? Now you're worshiping on paradise, now you're not. You know, it just changed, right? You got to go with the flow, right? Okay, let's keep going here.
The physiologic equipment and the anatomic structure of all new orders of life are in response to the action of physical law. But the subsequent endowment of mind is a bestowal of the adjutant mind spirits in accordance with innate brain capacity. Mind, while not a physical evolution, is wholly dependent on the brain capacity afforded by purely physical and evolutionary developments.
Okay, you see, we already really see brought that up. See what they're bringing in. It's just the mind engages the electrochemical mechanism below, and the electrochemical mechanism has to meet certain prerequisites for a particular adjutant to engage, right? I mean, it takes you till roughly age 6 for your electrochemical mechanism, your brain, to be something that seventh adjutant can engage, right? Finally, that brain matures to the point where the final seventh adjutant can engage, and then and only then can you be in circuit in the Holy Spirit, and then and only then can a personality engage you, and etc. There's no magic. It all has, it's all very, definitively a fact of law and logic. Everything. And you'll be experts in all this physics, as you ascend, in the ages to come. But you see how they, like I said, they don't really bring in mind a lot, but they wanted to just throw it in a little bit here. So that you have a stimulus to do what I've been doing for, an hour now, right? trying to get you to recognize, that, there's no way to even remotely understand biologic systems without mind energy. Right. It's completely magical. How do you explain, a chameleon, say, or some, plant or animal, changing like that, relative to the environment without mind, right? Which bridges the gap between, the organism and the environment, links the two together. I mean, it's all just magical without mind. Phenotype issue. And genotype is one thing, exactly what chromosomes you got, right? But the phenotype issue, which is actually tied to environment, I mean, right, that's a very mysterious thing for biologists to try to figure out, because they're trying to rationalize it with just, billiard balls, right? Just, molecules.
Remember when they gave the example of scientists not believing that hydrogen and oxygen would come together if you didn't know it?
Yeah, that super additive consequence of hydrogen and oxygen, right, to give water.
If there's no other proof for God, they say, or something like that. That's right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and again, just the fact that there has to be something above the matter, right? Mind is a super additive consequence, right? So the mind is above the matter, so it can coordinate, these things that matter does, that you look at it just down in the plane, it's like, wow, this is all like magical. Why is this stuff working together in some coordination? It's like there's invisible hands, It's like, no, there's no invisible hand. It's being engaged from the top down. Right? Okay. And then the last little comment there.
Through almost endless cycles of gains and losses, adjustments and readjustments, all living organisms swing back and forth from age to age. Those that attain cosmic unity persist, while those that fall short of this goal cease to exist.
Okay. One thing, just, think about how it harkens back to what I was saying about, life is a test. Things are going to change. Those that attain cosmic unity persist. Would you like to be in that category? Or, those that fall short of this goal cease to exist.
If you really want to be changed, door number C.
Right. Through almost endless cycles of gains and losses, adjustments and readjustments. I mean, that's the domain you live in. Don't have any illusions. Right? It's a varying domain. Yeah, but, so there's that. That just strengthens what I was saying. But what it really, the most immediate thing is, okay, they threw in a little paragraph about mind, just immediate in a local sense. Where do you get your mind from? The creative mother spirit, right? What's that that last paragraph without literally saying it? What are they talking about there? When they say those that attain cosmic unity, and of course it's a cosmic unity, we're talking about the tri-unity, those that synchronize with the universal harmony persist, those that don't, okay? What are they talking about? If something is ongoing, it's being upheld. All right, what's that final paragraph about? The upholder, about the mother, right? You either synchronize with her nature, you make yourself cosmic in nature because she's your cosmic mother, so you have to be like her, you know, or, you know, if you're not like her, or she can't uphold you, you fall through her hand, right? All those species that have, you know, come and gone, you know, why aren't they here anymore? You know, is it because, you know, evil humans, you know, like especially Westerners, you know, killed them? No. No, that's not the reason for the Permian extinction. Why have all those species disappeared? Because they were no longer upheld, so they disappeared.
So she's upholding the mosquitoes and the flies.
She upholds the mosquitoes and yes and everything.
She didn't decide not to uphold them
anymore. Right, and see, it has nothing to, has no decision on her part. You either are like her, and then she just upholds you because that's the kind of deity she has, is upholding deity. It just functions that way. Or, you know, it's, you know, and see, and that's the thing about with us, with free will, ultimately it's in our free will hands. Do you want to be upheld or not? Well, isn't there any other options? No. It's a binary thing. It's just one or the other. Either you precisely conform or eventually you cease to exist.
Right? But the beauty is it's a loving hand.
Yeah, and it's a loving hand, right? I mean, it's doing, you know, effectively an infinite number of things to help you, right? I mean, you have all the help you could ever need. I mean, it wants to uphold you, right? All you have to do is just allow it to happen, right? Don't be so self-righteous and prideful, right? I mean, that you say, "Oh, you're not the boss of me. I can uphold myself," right? No, you need an upholder. See, and again, see, the father doesn't, you know, isn't poking his hand in there, right? You know, it's already there. He doesn't need to. He's delegated that finite upholding. Yeah, he's the infinite upholder, upholding the infinite level, but that's a little bit above the finite level where I'm at. Right? This is going to do me any good. I'm not an infinite being. I can't be upheld by him. I need a finite upholder. I need the mother. Universal mother to uphold me. Okay, then we got a fun little section here that they throw in to wrap up this paper.
Section 7, the Geologic History Book. The vast group of rock systems which constituted the outer crust of the world during the life dawn or Proterozoic era does not now appear at many points on the Earth's surface. And when it does emerge from below all the accumulations of subsequent ages, there will be found only the fossil remains of vegetable and early primitive animal life. Some of these older water-deposited rocks are commingled with subsequent layers, and sometimes they yield fossil remains of some of the earlier forms of vegetable life. While on the topmost layers occasionally may be found some of the more primitive forms of the early marine animal organisms. In many places, these oldest stratified rock layers bearing the fossils of the early marine life, both animal and vegetable, may be found directly on top of the older undifferentiated stone.
Okay, so just, you know, we'll get into these details a little bit more when we get to the next paper, but this 150 million years that we've been sweeping through here, that's the Proterozoic, and you know, initially, because we're talking about, you know, a lot of times even microscopic life and stuff here, or you know, nothing that has skeletons or whatnot, you know, our shells. I mean, you know, we weren't even aware that there was life back here, you know, but eventually we started, wait a minute, you know, here's something that Precambrian, then it's got, you know, there's, this is obviously an organism that left this impression in this mud, you know. Yeah, and so, you know, that they're just, you know, giving you a little bit about that, that, yeah, that, you know, if you, and, you know, we now have found all, you know, the more you look, the more you find some of these things that just happen to get preserved in subtle ways. And a lot of times, like they're saying, I mean, you're getting right down there to, you know, to, you know, genuine Precambrian bedrock. You know, undifferentiated stone stuff they're talking about there. All right, so these very earliest layers of eukaryotic life, remember? Right, remember again when we're talking when they say life dawn, right? That's eukaryotic life dawn, not prokaryotes. Yeah. So you know, you can go study this as much as you like. You know, look up things on the internet. But this is that early phase that we're talking about, and yeah, and, you know, and it gets, obviously when it's that old, like they're mentioning, it can get really complicated. I mean, that stuff has gotten, you know, upthrust and jumbled up with, you know, much more recent stuff, and you know, you have to very carefully sort this all out. It can get complicated. But if nothing else, no matter where you find it, you go, whoa, this is a really, really ancient, you know, fossil impression here. This is from way back in those that early Proterozoic stage, you know, what literally Proterozoic means is former life. You know, like I said, because initially they thought life like this, you know, started in the beginning of the Cambrian, and so they say, oh, there's stuff that's prior to that. You know, this is the former life, you know, age here. This Proterozoic. If you want to go back to the earlier than that, you know, that's that really ancient life. That's the Archaeozoic, you know, as they call it. And again, like, we'll get that in the next paper here. But that's so they just want to they want to help starting here, kind of giving you a basic orientation into the picture of you know, if you don't know anything about historical geology, if you've never studied this sort of stuff before. Okay.
Fossils of this era yield algae, coral-like plants, primitive protozoa, and sponge-like transition organisms. But the absence of such fossils in the early rock layers does not necessarily prove that living things were not elsewhere in existence at the time of their deposition. Life was sparse throughout these early times and only slowly made its way over the face of the earth.
See how they just throw in these little points where, you know, if you're going to study this, there's going to be some questions you have that you have no way of answering, right? So they answer them for you. And you might say, well, I wonder, you know, if really quickly life was everywhere, so I can really assume, you know, that if I don't find it here, you know, it's nowhere on the planet that far back. You know, it's like, well, I don't know, how could I figure that out, right? You know, so they just tell you, right? See, that's the sort of thing, it's a data point, you know, to help pin down your scientific investigation. And like I've said several times, you know, there's, you know, we're not even remotely going to try to point out all those sorts of scientific anchor points that they're constantly throwing out, but you know, if there's something that's kind of straightforward like that, I'll mention it. That's why they, you know, they didn't just waste a whole paragraph in the book, you know, for no reason. I mean, if they're telling you that, it's because there's some unresolvable question from a human perspective. Right? We can't figure it out ourselves. They're allowed to tell us that fact.
Mm-hmm. Right? So most of the life is in these sheltered bays, out right, in the wide ocean or on the land.
Yeah, not much. Awful lot of stuff, right? There's no life at all anywhere, yeah. So it's just as old a rock, right? But yeah, and you can also tell we're just starting to get sedimentary rock happening. You know, I mean, initially all we had was igneous rock, right? But now we're getting to the point where, you know, things aren't constantly being churned up. You know, stuff is sitting there for a while and starting to erode, and you're starting to get sedimentary deposits happening. You know, before that, we didn't have any sedimentary rock. Right? So we're getting into the point where we have some, you know, the initial layers of sedimentary rock, and sure enough, you start finding these little fossil impressions in it occasionally, if you happen to pick the right spot. Right?
The rocks of this olden age are now at the Earth's surface, or very near the surface, over about 1/8 of the present land area. The average thickness of this transition stone, the oldest stratified rock layers, is about 1.5 miles. At some points, these ancient rock systems are as much as 4 miles thick, but many of the layers which have been ascribed to this era belong to later periods.
So you can just see how they're just giving you some basic points. So that's not, you know, that's not a, in general, let's not try to engage it scientifically. But just, you know, just think about how this is helping to paint a basic picture for you. And it's like, well, how many strata, you know, how deep a set of layers are we talking about here? If you're not familiar with this, you know, maybe that really strikes you. It's like, oh my goodness, seriously? 4 miles thick of this stuff, and this is just that really, really early stuff? Yeah, you know, there's a lot of strata, right? If you're not familiar with just how, I mean, y'all know that the Grand Canyon is pretty deep, right? There's a lot of sedimentary rock piled up on that Precambrian stuff down at the bottom. You know, Precambrian, you know, igneous rock, you know, or metamorphic rock that's, you know, down at the bottom of things. But just, you know, so they do that all through the thing. They'll toss out those little touchstones. So you know, the scientist always has a kind of a rule of thumb, you know, as he's trying to kind of go beyond, you know, some local context where he's studying it, and he's trying to think about how that fits into the bigger global picture. It's like, well, you know, it's this thick here. I wonder how, if that was, you know, was that pretty much all over the whole world? You know, it starts to get tough to extrapolate when you only have a few places you can look, you know, and so they're just trying to help you to eventually be able to have a true geology, right?
And that would fall into the authoritative elimination of error.
Right. You have a lot of disclosure.
Almost screwed that up.
Yeah. You have a lot of disclosure of fact when you're in areas that there's no way humans can, you know, get a definitive answer. You know, it's like, well, okay, I think that's probably the case, but I'm, you know, I still have this little bit of, you know, question mark, you know, it'd be really handy if I could really definitively pin that down and go forward, you know, instead of having that question mark dangling as I try to go forward. Yeah. Okay.
Do we still have the same radiometrics in play here? Or is it
I mean, we haven't gotten out of the out of the 450 to 400 million years ago block. Yeah, we're at the last part of the Proterozoic here. Yeah.
In North America, this ancient and primitive fossil-bearing stone layer comes to the surface over the eastern, central, and northern regions of Canada. There is also an intermittent east-west ridge of this rock, which extends from Pennsylvania in the ancient Adirondack Mountains on west through Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Other ridges run from Newfoundland to Alabama and from Alaska to Mexico.
Yeah, just, again, you know, just so you, you know, like I said, I mean, if you're not familiar at all, it's like, oh, okay, I'm getting a little bit of a picture here. Right, where they're trying to make us armchair scientists a little bit here, right? You know, they're trying to give us a little bit of a scientific grounding in these things. So if you have some religion, right, you can put the two together, and maybe you can get a super additive consequence. Right? But you need a fact-based science, right? Not a figment-based science that religionists love to make up, right? something that's grounded in the facts. Okay.
The rocks of this era are exposed here and there all over the world, but none are so easy of interpretation as those about Lake Superior and in the Grand Canyon of the Colorado River, where these fossil, primitive fossil-bearing rocks existing in several layers testify to the upheavals and surface fluctuations of those faraway times.
And she said, you know, you'll see all kinds of disruption. You know, it's going to be hard to find, you know, these beautifully, perfectly flat beds, you know, that aren't disrupted at all. I mean, you know, you go way back, things are going to often be quite disrupted. You know, and it's really a cool find to find something that's, you know, sort of basically as it was laid down all those millions of years ago. Okay.
The stone layer, the oldest fossil-bearing stratum in the crust of the Earth, has been crumpled, folded, and grotesquely twisted as a result of the upheavals of earthquakes in the early volcanoes. The lava flows of this age brought much iron, copper, and lead up near the planetary surface.
Okay. Maybe just one thing that jumps out. Why would they say grotesquely twisted instead of, like, you know, greatly twisted or radically twisted or something or whatever? They're trying to remind you, you know, if you'd gone way back those times and seen some of this stuff, oh, it's so beautiful. I'll bet you God is going to grab a hold of that and never let that change. I mean, he would never let beauty like that go away. No. It's now grotesque relative to the beauty it once had. And I was like, well, that doesn't make sense to me. You know, that's because you need to reflect on the nature of beauty. Beauty doesn't exist in the matter and in time here. Beauty exists in eternity. Beauty is the aisle. If anything, any experience you have here strikes you as beautiful, what really is happening, it's not what it appears to be. It appears that an object is beautiful, or a, you know, like a setting, you know, of sunset or something is beautiful. That's what it appears, but that's not really the case. But really, it's a little window that's opened up. And you aren't actually seeing beauty. You're using your insight to see, quote-unquote, through that window, quote-unquote, to the aisle. All beauty is the aisle, the absolute of beauty. And all beauty, you know, an animal can't recognize beauties. Doesn't matter how beautiful the arrangement of molecules appears to be, no animal looks at it and says, well, that's beautiful. Right? Because they don't have insight. They can't see through the arrangement of molecules to eternity and the aisle beyond and become aware of beauty. So that's another thing. Why do we get so white-knuckled desperately trying to hold on to certain arrangements of molecules? Because we think that it really is what it appears to be. That the arrangement of molecules is beautiful. Right? It's like, no. Yeah, beauty is in eternity. Just the light that you happen to be there, like someone could have delighted to be there way back at this time when these beds were beautiful before they became grotesque. And you could have seen the aisle through that arrangement of molecules. But the molecules aren't beautiful. Right? Your insight through them is where the beauty lies. Beauty is something that you abstract from the immediate aspect of it. It's not really right in front of you. That should get you thinking about beauty. But see, that's why they did that. Because they know that's, like that's why I've been stressing. We're really getting confused about this. Right? We're trying to make the dirt balls around us the Isle of Paradise. You know, we're thinking, because we're thinking their beauty. No, the aisle is beauty. Just the light that you were fortunate enough to happen to be there, well, a fleeting glimpse of the aisle shone through the benighted molecules of time. Right? The shadow cast of the aisle into time, right? And you saw it for that fleeting moment that the shadow passed. Okay?
There are few places on the Earth where such activities are more graphically shown than in the St. Croix Valley of Wisconsin. In this region, there occurred 127 successive lava flows on land with succeeding water submergence and consequent rock deposition. Although much of the upper rock sedimentation and intermittent lava flow is absent today, and though the bottom of this system is buried deep in the earth, nevertheless about 65 or 70 of these stratified records of past ages are now exposed to view.
Why did they throw that paragraph in there? Okay, because remember we've got sedimentary rock right now. Can you date sedimentary rock with radiometric dating? No, because what does radiometric dating date? It's the crystallization age, right? I mean, some little crystal in some sedimentary deposit, you know, you're not interested in, you know, how many billion, you know, 3 billion years ago it was, you know, it crystallized and now it's been ground into a little, you know, sand grain that's in this sandstone or something, right? You don't care about, you want to know when the sandstone was there. Well, there's no way to date when the sandstone was cemented together. Unless, what if you had some sandstone and right below it there was a little bit of lava, and you could date when that crystallized, and right above it there was a little bit of lava, and you can date when that was crystallized. Right. Oh, the sandstone in between is a little bit older than that lava above and a little bit younger than the lava below. Ooh, handy.
Yeah.
That's what they're reminding you. Just, yeah. I mean, any geologist, you know, knows that, but, you know, they're trying to teach non-geologists, too, is to get you to think about this. See, so you can go, oh, I've never thought about that. If you can get that in your head and really, you put a potential in your mind you haven't had before. You juxtapose that with your religious consciousness and there could be a super additive consequence that wasn't possible before. If you have this nice, tidy little logical understanding of just that simple little issue like that. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to spark a super additive consequence, give you some of these basic facts. You know, they don't explain why they put that paragraph in there. Right? They want you to ask why and figure it out.
Right? 65 or 70, you got to go figure out how many.
You're going, oh, well, that'll give me a lot of data points, right? I could really, I see.
I thought maybe this is a really beautiful valley.
Oh, it is. It's, yeah, right. I mean, if you haven't been there, yeah. Yeah, it's a destination in for sure. Yep.
In these early ages, when much land was near sea level, there occurred many successive submergences and emergences. The Earth's crust was just entering upon its later period of comparative stabilization. The undulations, rises and dips of the earlier continental drift contributed to the frequency of the periodic submergence of the great land masses.
See how they're talking about continental drift in contrast to plate tectonics like we talked about so much there, right? And remember, it's still kind of plastic. It's not rigid. You don't have plates yet. You know, see, like they're describing there, you've got this more plastic thing, you know, that's, you know, flexing about and whatnot, like we described before. So you can see they come really close to just, you know, stating it right there, what I've been stressing. But again, you see another thing there, just reminding you, if you aren't familiar with historical geology, you're not aware of how dry land has come and gone and come and gone and come and gone and come and gone. And there's nothing internal about dry land. You can't think in those terms.
It takes time.
Yeah, it takes time. But, you know, time is chugging on. And in the future, what's land and what's water will be different than what it is now. That's just the way it is. It isn't because humans are corrupting the eternity of the central universe. That's not what's behind it.
But it isn't as, it doesn't flex
right
now the
right
same way
now it, yeah, it isn't like, you know, now things are a little bit different with the plates, right? So, you know, you don't have it just like Boeing. It's like, okay, now most of North America is underwater, okay, now most of North America is above water, and okay, now most of North America is below water. You know, it isn't doing that, you know. But you can know things like when you get back and look at the Front Range, you know, note Long's Peak and Pike's Peak. And we'll get to that eventually. And, you know, remember, those are the older mountain system. They were part of what was there before you had all the rest of it. And there was a time when those were the only two things that were sticking above the ocean. Of course, Long's Peak and Pike's Peak were a lot bigger than they are right now, right? But, you know, they were like, you know, like Hawaii sticks up out of the ocean, right? Right? There were these huge mountains, you know, that rose up and had their heads above the ocean that surrounded us there everywhere. And again, it's even if that such dramatic fashion doesn't happen going forward in the future, it's important to incorporate that into your sense of where you fit into the earth. Right? You know, if you don't want oceans to come and go, you have to go to a place where there aren't oceans. You have to go to an architectural sphere. Okay? But if you live on a planet with oceans, okay, islands come and go, you know. I mean, yeah, think how beautiful some of those tiny little Hawaiian islands that are way off to the west used to be before they were eroded down to almost nothing. You know? And they were as big as the Big Island, right? Yeah, and eventually they'll all be gone.
New ones will take their place.
There were all kinds of beautiful islands in the Pacific before the glaciers melted and submerged them all. Yeah, now you got all these people live. You know, they don't even living on, you know, really solid ground. They live on a little pile of coral that's on top of the mountain. You know, the mountain is completely underwater. I mean, this is a pile of coral on top of it, and they're living on that. I mean, you know, that's like living on sandbars, right? That's pretty ridiculous. You know, if you think you're going to live there for all eternity.
Like the Marshall Islands.
Yeah.
Right now.
All right, I mean, just, all right. You know, the glaciers haven't finished melting yet. I mean, eventually all the ice will melt, no matter what humans do. I mean, the only reason that there's still ice is because the ice age hasn't come to an end yet. So the ocean's got to rise a lot further yet, no matter what humans do.
Listen, I have a stupid question. Yeah. I probably know the answer, but I can't think of it now. Why did the Earth produce ice ages? What happened
to
the
ice age? Well, we'll eventually get there, but just in a quick nutshell, you eventually got a temperature differential between the pole and the equator. You know, it used to be it was the same temperature all around because it was a marine climate. Eventually got enough land where you got a temperature differential. And you had these big, you know, back from these continental drift days, you had areas that were way flexed up really high. And so when it started to snow, Right? We don't have high elevations like that anymore. So the elevations that continental drift produced, that plate tectonics doesn't produce, you know, plus the, you know, finally getting the temperature differential. Yeah. Okay.
During these times of primitive marine life, extensive areas of the continental shores sank beneath the seas from a few feet to half a mile. Much of the older sandstone and conglomerates represent the sedimentary accumulations of these ancient shores. The sedimentary rocks belonging to this early stratification rest directly upon those layers which date back far beyond the origin of life, back to the early appearance of the worldwide ocean.
I think you can, that's pretty straightforward. Why don't you just leave that as it is?
Some of the upper layers of these transition rock deposits contain small amounts of shale or slate of dark colors, indicating the presence of organic carbon and testifying to the existence of the ancestors of those forms of plant life which overran the earth during the succeeding Carboniferous or Coal Age. Much of the copper in these rock layers results from water deposition. Some is found in the cracks of the older rocks and is the concentrate of the sluggish swamp water of some ancient sheltered shoreline. The iron mines of North America and Europe are located in deposits and extrusions lying partly in the older unstratified rocks and partly in these later stratified rocks of the transition periods of life formation.
Okay, again, you know, a lot of that just kind of giving you the bigger picture. Notice they're reminding you, okay, if you're going to get these, you know, these very dark shales, right, you know, you've got organic carbon, right, that's behind that. So even if you don't find literally a fossil, right, you can find evidence of organic carbon, you know, indicating that there was life way back then. You don't know what the heck it looked like, right? How it was shaped or whatnot, but you know it was there.
So yeah. These large iron ore deposits are extrusions, volcanic extrusions?
Yeah, you remember how they said the lava flows of this age brought much iron, copper, and lead up near the planetary surface? I mean, there's obviously a lot of different reasons for all this stuff. I mean, you know, some of it is even meteor, meteoric deposits, you know, but and so you're starting to get all of this complexity. They're just kind of reminding you of, you know, you actually have it in solution, you know, and it's coming out of solution and filling up cracks, you know, with shiny metal. My precious. okay.
This era witnesses the spread of life throughout the waters of the world. Marine life has become well established on Urantia. The bottoms of the shallow and extensive inland seas are being gradually overrun by profuse and luxuriant growth of vegetation, while the shoreline waters are swarming with the simple forms of animal life.
Okay, see, so now they're pointing out, okay, now it's getting where it's, you know, by the time you get to the end of the Proterozoic, you know, things have pretty much spread into every nook and cranny. Okay, so that's basically how they leave you, with just one little poetic ending here.
All of this story is graphically told within the fossil pages of the vast stone book of world record. And the pages of this gigantic biogeologic record unfailingly tell the truth if you but acquire skill in their interpretation. Many of these ancient seabeds are now elevated high upon land, and their deposits of age upon age tell the story of the life struggles of those early days. It is literally true. As your poet has said, the dust we tread upon was once alive. Presented by a member of the Urantia Life Carrier Corps, now resident on the planet.
Okay, I'll get to the two things in quotes here in a second, but just notice in the middle, see how it's what I've been saying that they're trying to do here? Right, in the pages of this gigantic biogeologic record, unfailingly tell the truth if you but acquire skill in their interpretation. Right, the relevancers are trying to give you what you need so you can actually find the logic of the earth. Right, there can be a geology, right, and not just a rationalization of the earth, right, but the actual true logic of the earth. Okay, so that's, you can see how that's the point. They're trying to give you what you need so that you can acquire the skill and you can interpret things logically, not merely rationally, because you can rationalize anything. But can you correctly rationalize it? Okay, and then the two things, that the fun little things they're throwing in there in quotes. Maybe just start with the last one. It is literally true, as your poet has said, the dust we tread upon was once alive. That's a little chunk from Lord Byron. And there's a reason, right, that's thrown in. There's a very classic geologic text, you know, that was there at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, that basically between the lines of relevancers are saying, you know, we used that text, you know, to play off of for our discourse here. It's by Charles Lyell. Charles quotes, you know, Lyell quotes Byron, and it's a classic quote. You know, many people refer to, and don't forget, you know, when Charles Lyell quoted Lord Byron, you know, and they delight in that little poetic flourish that Lyell threw in there. You know, Lyell is one of the greats of the beginning of geology. So there's, you know, they're just between the lines, they're just telling you that The Elements of Geology by Charles Lyell is you know, mm-hmm. was something they were playing off of. Okay, the other one, quote-unquote stone book, there's another book from that same, you know, the latter part of the 19th century called The Great Stone Book of Nature by David Thomas Anstead. David Thomas Anstead. It was originally published back in 1863. See, that's another one that they're, indirectly saying. Yeah, and we tried to take kind of the best thoughts that you had of synthesizing, the information you had, and we played off of that. That one, you'll see they mention again, quote unquote, and we begin the next paper. So I'll hold off a delightful little tidbit about that one until that time. But the fun thing about Lyell's Elements of Geology, those had many additions over the course of the 19th century. The final one, kind of feeding forward to the revelation here, is called The Student's Elements of Geology. That was in 1871. And it's kind of a fun little thing to note. All right, so, the last thing in this paper is, quoting Lord Byron there from Lyell's, so you're keyed on that. And you flip to the title of the next paper, The Marine Life Era on Urantia. It's really fun to just look in Lyell's book and notice just shortly after he quotes Lord Byron, he's got a new section. That next section is entitled Freshwater and Marine Fossils. So,
it's interesting that the human texts they use weren't from the 20th century. Earlier geologists may have had more.
I tried to stress that. I mean, those are like just seminal texts. Were really what everyone was using. Lyell is the great Lyell. Those were like the Bibles, right? You could still literally look up. Religionists that have web pages where they have an online copy, of Lyell's text. They still really treat that as the Bible, of this that they're contemplating their religion relative to, for instance. I mean, it's a very seminal text.
Canon.
Okay. There's no end to the delights that you can have if you burrow into text, even if they aren't using them in kind of any sort of a direct parallel fashion, they're just basically using them as a rough template. Still, no matter who the author is, they love to throw in little things like that. It's like, I wonder if they'll notice that right after, that quote from the poet, what the title of the next section is, it's just fun to. The more you're interested in a particular scientific field that might be touched upon, you can burrow into those details and find all sorts of delightful tidbits that you can, mine from the unspoken statements, the subtle little tongue-in-cheeks. You know how many times the revelators love to throw in puns, and little jokes. I mean, they're trying to help you to not be so serious about it, because religionists can get so serious, It's like, come on, lighten up, people, have some fun here. They love alliteration, you can be playful and yet be, earnest, right? Yeah. You don't have to be hyper serious to be earnest. Okay, all right, so we'll start to really get into stepping through those geologic eras now, one paper at a time. For those of you who haven't taken a historical geology course, this will be your introduction to what was it like when humans looked like trilobites,
<That's> scary.
All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.